chromosome reason, or, you know, I don't know how to defend against my size. I'm not sure what to say.
So the main accusation is that your daughter is too short.
Yep.
And other accusations are ones that have been recycled from the past and have been found to be without any grounds?
Yeah. Well, there's one, my chaotic lifestyle was one of the things on the petition. And, you know, even me and my lawyer looked at each other. We're like, what is that supposed to mean? You know, I mean, I'm a mom, so, you know, possibly stepping on a Lego, trying to get a kid dressed. That's about as chaotic as it gets.
are you working?
Right now I was in between jobs. I have a rheumatoid arthritis and was trying to get back into the work program right now.
In the past, you've worked as a dental assistant, is that right?
Surgical dental assistant, yes. Yeah, we used to do surgeries with the children that had epilepsy, seizures. The medication causes their gums to grow over their teeth, and so very heartbreaking, very hard job to do, but, I mean, it was very fulfilling.
And so you're working on getting back into work as a dental assistant?
Actually, I might try to get back in another, because I used to work for Scholastic Books. We did the book fairs for all the schools. I don't know if you heard of it. The Big Red Dog, Clifford. I worked there for years, and I think something more along that lines, or like towards the library, less strenuous on the body.
Yeah, and in the meantime, you are having to go to a trial to try and get your children back?
Yeah.
And yeah, you have a lawyer representing you?
Yeah, I have a court-appointed lawyer. And so far, she's, you know, she seems to be a firecracker. I'm hoping. We seem to be a good team.
Wow. And so how can people find out more about your case and about the Department of Human Services here in Oregon taking children for the issue of being too short or having so-called failure to thrive for short stature?
Well, I do have a Mad Angel's Journey to Bring Her Children Home page on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter, Pure Mad Angel, Angela Bortz, or linked as Angela Bortz on any one of them. And, of course, you know, I'm connected with a lot of advocates, and we kind of go through any kind of issues that where children are being removed in medical cases where, you know, it's, say, a chromosome thing or a genetic thing that it's basically they don't understand what's going on, so they're holding on to these kids and keeping them away from the parents, you know, when the children really need them the most.
So, KBOO listeners will keep in mind those three children and your struggle to get them back from the Child Protective Services that removed them on March 3rd after a pediatrician said that your daughter was too short and
yep.
And not tall enough for a six-year-old. Thank you, Angela Borth, for joining us today on KBOO. Again, I'm speaking with Angela Borth, a mother here in Portland, whose three children were removed by Child Protective Services. She is working to get them back home again. Angela, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate this.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
We're at the Erez Crossing, which is where you enter Gaza from. So apparently, when you go into Gaza, you have to walk until you get to the first town there. And apparently that walk is very dangerous.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom. Thursday, April 9th at 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 338. Guest speaker will be Stephen Saleta, former Virginia Tech professor. That's Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom, sponsored by Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, on Thursday, April 9th, 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University, Smith Center, room 338. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, this is Labor Radio Show, and I'm Lane Ponce, your host this evening. This is our fifth Monday show. We have two very interesting guests tonight. We have Susan Stoner, who is an author of the Sage Adair Historical Museum Mystery Series. Should be in a museum, right? And we also have with us tonight Laura Hayden, who is going to be telling us about a listening party and oral history workshop, as well as other things she's involved in with oral history. And why don't we just jump right in and talk to Susan? Susan, tell us more about what's going on with Sage Adair, the mystery man.
Well, we released Black Drop last year, and it's done well, and people seem to like it. That's the one about Teddy Roosevelt coming to Portland. Just to sort of back up, it's the series takes place during the Progressive Era, which is sort of the beginning of the 1900s, and the hero is a labor union organizer and secret operative. And so the fifth book, which is the one that's going to be coming out in July, is called Deadline, and it takes place in Central Oregon.
Does it have anything to do with newspapers? Deadline newspaper?
No. One of the problems was there is a lot of use of Deadline. Deadline in this case sort of harkens back to when they had prisons in the South, and they would draw a line or make a line, and if a prisoner crossed that line, they would be shot on site and killed. So it's in Oregon, we had a range war, or almost a range war, and one of the things that happened is they put deadlines across the rangeland and basically said, if you're a shepherd or your sheep, if your shepherd or your sheep stray across this deadline, they will be killed. So that's kind of what this is about.
Okay.
Of course, there's a murder mystery.
So. Oh, well, yes, because he solves murder mysteries. People die if there's a deadline. Okay, let's have you present what you're doing, and then we'll just have a conversation about your work and how it's similar and how it's different.
Sure. My name's Laura Haddon, and I'm working on a project called Wage Working with my collaborator, Tennessee Watson. And our project is an oral history project along the lines of Studs Terkel, largely inspired by his 1974 book, Working. And it's audio interviews with people working all sorts of different types of jobs, and each interview is edited to the length of time it takes each person to earn a dollar. So the people who earn the least are given the most time to speak. And those stories are put into albums, and those albums are put into a jukebox. And the jukebox lives in the community where the stories take place and the people live and the workers are contributing. And so we're going to begin this project in Portland this summer. And I'm going to be presenting a little bit about the project on April 7th at the University of Oregon in Portland as part of this this program called Listen Hard, Stories of Resistance and Resilience that's being put on by Groundswell Oregon.
Groundswell.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little about Groundswell, or do you know them? Have you worked with them?
I am new to them because I'm new to Portland, but they are a national organization that has local chapters, and this is the Oregon chapter of Groundswell, and there are oral historians or people doing oral history work focused on social change.
And Susan, you were just saying that you also have worked on oral histories.
Yes.
For
a long time, Oregon, Oregon has not done a good job of accumulating history, labor history, just in general. And it's very difficult to find labor history in Oregon. But Jim Strassmeyer, when he worked as the oral historian for the Oregon Historical Society, began doing oral histories of people who were significant in the labor movement before they died. And so I've been helping with that in terms of fundraising for it and things like that. Very important thing, especially for someone like me when I'm trying to research and I can't find anything at all about oral history. And the most valuable thing really is that original source material from the people who were there and lived it, because it has a vibrancy that you just can't get if you're reading a dry tome about, you know, the history of Oregon.
When you say that you're collecting oral histories, are you including labor union people or is it more broad?
It's broad. It doesn't not include labor union people, but it's a larger picture.
How do you pick people to be interviewed?
That's a great question. So there's a whole bunch of different ways it happens. It can either be people are approaching us, perhaps that they'd be interested, and we talk to them, see if it would be a good fit. The project actually started, my collaborator and I got a artist residency in upstate New York, in Hudson, New York. Actually, it was outside of Hudson in a town called Cairo in Accra, New York. And we didn't know the community at all. It was 2 months. We were living in New York City at the time. We just went up there for 2 months. So a lot of our time was spent sort of driving around these two counties that we were working in and just sort of trying to figure out what was going on and approaching people and just cold asking and cold calling people and saying, hey, we'd really like to tell your story or like to hear what you have to say about working and specifically working in this community. And we'd approach people that way. And so sometimes we'd collect enough stories that we would realize, oh, for example, we knew that the prison industry was huge in that community. It was the largest employer in those two counties. And so we knew that we needed to have some sort of representation of that. And we wanted to have one story that was at least from that, at least one story. And so from the very beginning, we worked on getting permission to actually record an oral history inside the prison and got three inmates on work assignment to talk about sort of what it was like running the recycling center inside of the prison.
Okay. And so now you've got a grant to come to Oregon. Is that how that worked, through Groundswell?
Not exactly. So I independently relocated to Portland in August, and my collaborator and I wanted to keep the project alive. It's been going on for a couple years, and I actually got a grant, or we got a grant through Southeast Uplift to do the project in Southeast Portland. And Groundswell is sort of a collective. It's all people, someone doing work independently, sometimes collaboratively. There's not a lot of finances or money involved. It's not a funding body. But I was sort of invited to join this group as I'm doing this work that's related to the work that everyone else is doing, which is really exciting.
And you use these kind of oral histories for research in your books, right?
I use them for research in my book and for characters and for incidents that are unique to individuals that I might then later use in some way. So I don't use a lot of oral histories as of yet because the era that I write in, the progressive era, is not one that had oral history. So I use a lot of diaries, letters, things like that.
A different form of history.
Yeah. Like one thing that was very, well, two things that were really important. One was a story from a man who was grew up outside of Sisters, and his parents had the very first recreational place for people to go from Portland and spend the week or something out near Sisters, Oregon. And then the other one was a guy who used to drive the stagecoach. And so they were just so unique. And that's what I like about when I read the oral histories that people are doing now, is this really unique people and what drives them and what motivates them and what challenges they've had to overcome is kind of inspiring.
Well, Laura, how did you get involved in this sort of work? It's from your college days or?
I started out largely in documentary media. That's when I went and I studied in college, was documentary filmmaking, and I liked that, and I thought that I would be pursuing that. And oral history is obviously related to documentary, very deeply related to it. But after I graduated from college, I got an AmeriCorps position with the Center for Digital Storytelling in Berkeley, which teaches people sort of how to tell their own stories and use multimedia tools to sort of tell their own stories. So I got involved with them and as a facilitator. And then when I moved out to New York, I got involved yet again with storytelling at an organization called The Moth that does live storytelling. And so I was on the side doing grad school for documentary work. And I was thinking, you know, these things are really related, but what's the common core of what I love about each of these things? And I think oral history sort of lives in that great intersection. It's people going out and seeking out these stories and helping people that might not otherwise find the tools or think about their story in terms of a larger context, sort of bring that to a larger public awareness.
So you're working with contemporary people. People that are still working or maybe retired people.
Mm-hmm. I'm working with all live people, yes.
Live people. Alive people, yes.
Yep. Alive people, yep.
And what have you done so far in Portland?
So I'm just getting started here in Portland. A lot of it's just been setting up the back the sort of the legwork of how it's going to roll out in the summer. The fieldwork begins mid-June, and we will be hosting three different the jukebox in three different locations in Southeast Portland. So trying to work on what that's going to be. We want to get really different sort of venues. So hopefully, you know, one space like a bar where you wouldn't maybe normally see a jukebox, but definitely not an oral history jukebox. But then other spaces where you would reach a different audience, like a laundromat or something like that. So it's beginning to sort of look at what community spaces would be good partners for this, as well as who would we like to profile and what sort of community organizations we want to link arms with. We are working with Know Your City, which is a great nonprofit here in Portland that sort of does creative placemaking projects, and we really think of ourselves in that way as well. So,
what do you mean exactly by placemaking?
So it is sort of all art that's based in understanding the community, and art and media projects and a whole bunch of neat things. So sort of creative solutions. So they do things like have kids create newspapers or newsletters from a particular area that's all staffed and done by the kids. They do walking tours that sort of tell alternative histories to Portland. Like, I'm not so familiar with their work, but we've really sort of fit in. It's nice that the work that they have or the programs that they run aren't necessarily united by form, but they're sort of united by like ethos, which is lovely.
And the here and now. And so are you getting referrals from organizations like that about, oh, you need to talk to this person?
We are getting recommendations, which is wonderful. It's a great place to start, and it sort of snowballs, right? The more people you talk to, the more ideas you get. Interviewing some person could get you thinking about maybe another industry that you hadn't thought about. And so, yes, so we're starting to get referrals. They're trickling in. I always love to hear more. So I welcome those as well.
Susan, we'll get back to your book in a minute, but I know you're doing the oral history project too. Is there one particular oral history you found very fascinating that you can tell us a little about, or even the process?
Yes. I worked for the Amalgamated Transit Union, and one person that was real key to its growth and was a guy named Mel Schopert. And quite frankly, he was kind of a difficult guy, especially for women. And he died a while back. In fact, his oral history was completed just before he died. And he was wonderful in a lot of ways, difficult in a lot of ways. And the oral history really sort of explained why this guy kind of turned out the way he did, what kind of things shaped him. He had been in the Marines and was in the group of people who was always first onto the islands in the South Pacific to attack the Japanese. And it was a horrific experience. And a lot of people, that might have crushed them, that might have turned them into very self-centered people. And yet he dedicated his life to working people. And I think I would say that's what I find inspiring about the research that I do, is people talk a lot about, you know, you don't want to repeat history or something like that. But for me, the value of knowing our history is that people learn that other people have had just as big a challenges, and they've managed to, and they were ordinary people, and yet they have managed to surmount those and create a better world for all of us that has lasted. It's a legacy. And when you do people like Laura's doing, which is just ordinary people, they, in my opinion, those are the people who created the good America, the one that's kind and generous and compassionate and does Boy Scouts and all of the church bake sales, all those kinds of wonderful things, comes out of the middle class, the working people. And so it's kind of a celebration. So that's what I like when I read an oral history, is to sort of see why this person took this path and realize it wasn't easy for, it's never easy for anybody.
Right. And the labor industry, the labor union people that work, they tend to be generous with their time and their efforts. So it's good that you were able to get him before he died and find out.
Yes, I didn't do that. Jim Strassmeyer did that oral history. And I've actually been more on the fundraising side because I was too busy with my job. And so I just sort of supported the people who were going out and doing the oral histories. And that some of them were retirees.
Yes, we have more time, right? Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell me one that you found that was really interesting in your work?
In terms of the interviews that I've already done? Gosh, there have been so many. So we've probably done, well, we're getting started, but we've done probably 20 interviews in terms of profiles of workers. And, you know, sometimes the inmates one obviously was huge and important for us because that's a community you generally don't hear from, that we generally don't interact with, and we don't think about prison work labor. And, you know, the stories are edited to the length of time it takes each person to earn a dollar. And for that story, they earn 33 cents an hour. Right, because they're paying back their room and board, right, for prison. Like that's the regulation. And so we actually, our jukebox took CDs, and we realized that we couldn't fit 3 hours. It takes them 3 hours to make a dollar, and that physically will not fit on a compact disc, which only holds 80 minutes. So we were sort of thrown for a loop for a second. We're like, the entire design of our project is not accommodating sort of this specific case. And when we got there, we saw. There was three of these young men who were working together, and we realized, you know, and we've done this a couple times, that their work was so intertwined together that we combined all three of their stories to create a 53-minute story, which is how long it took, you know, all of them together if they were pooling their money to earn a dollar. So that one had a pretty big impact on us. But, you know, that's kind of a little bit, I don't want to say at the extreme, but that's sort of a very specific example. But, you know, another interview that was really powerful is we went in and we interviewed a second grade teacher. And it's been a long time since I've been in second grade. And we just sat in that classroom for 3 hours and then interviewed her afterwards. And I'm not a parent, but being an adult in a children's classroom and seeing how much multitasking goes on was humbling. And just trying to follow her and all the work that she was doing. And there was two of us, and like we as media makers were overwhelmed trying to capture the scene. And yet she's responsible for all these kids. And then, you know, talking to her one-on-one afterwards and sort of interviewing her and sort of her motivation and how she thinks about her work and how much time and effort that we're not even seeing go into that day, go into those 3 hours, how much time that is, and how that's not recognized as labor or not compensated for as labor, was really powerful too.
Okay. Well, you know, you were talking about your job at the transit union. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us about your recent retirement and some of the highlights during your working career, sort of a little oral history of you?
Well, I guess the thing I really love the people that we represented were TriMet bus drivers, but also we represented people in Eugene, Salem, Corvallis, Medford, across the river in Vancouver, Walla Walla, Washington. So I got exposure, and school bus drivers, mechanics, and I really liked them as a group. I liked bus drivers because they are service oriented and they're always on time. And just really, I think, outgoing, pleasant folks. And so I felt really privileged to get to know and come to love quite a number of them, people that I worked with on grievances or other kinds of things. In terms of a story, I think my favorite story is when we were trying to get an initiative passed in Corvallis in order to raise the transit drivers' wages to, I don't know, they were getting $6.50 an hour, and so we were trying to raise it to what would be the average for the community bus drivers in the state of Oregon. And that, by the way, passed, and it passed the highest an initiative has ever passed, and it was like 65% people voted yes on it. So one of the things is I was doing all the PR work, and I was creating these television ads, and I used a quote from the guy that started the Oregon Journal, which is he talked about economic justice. Unless there's economic justice, then there is no democracy, was basically what he was saying. And so about 4 years after that, the operating engineers went down to organize the like housekeeping folks at the hospital in Corvallis. And they went into the organizing meeting, and all the housekeeping people were there, and they had a spokesperson that they had picked. And she got up and she said, and they said, well, what is it you want? And they said, we want economic justice, just like the bus drivers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the first time I really understood that when we're organizing, when we're talking about economic justice, what we're really doing is initiating a community dialogue that absolutely has to happen in this country. And so it did something. It changed Corvallis, and it did engage people in thinking about economic justice. So I think that was probably one of the finest things I've been involved with.
And your time as what was your title there? Were you there legal?
I was general counsel, in charge of all legal. But because it was very small staff, I also did PR and a lot of other things.
Sure.
Cleaned the toilets if they needed them, things like that. No, not really. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. But I would empty the dishwasher.
And in your free time is when you did the research going through archives and coming into plots for your books that took place around early 1900s, right?
Yes. Yeah, the first one starts in 1902.
And how far are you along now in that timeline?
The deadline right now is going to be July 1903. So I'm moving at a snail's pace. I don't want to go through if I keep writing, I don't want to go into the First World War because that was such a life changer for everybody in the world, really.
Right.
So
you're keeping the plots
tight.
Yeah,
I like the progressives because they wanted to do a lot of what we're trying to do now, you know.
Well, that seems evident in your books. There's always, when I'm reading them, because now we're on, the fifth?
Yeah.
The next one will be the fifth?
Right.
So I've read all four.
Thank you.
And there's many things when you're reading along and you're thinking about 1902, and then, wait a minute, this is just like what's going on now, only we call it something different or the circumstances are a little different.
Yeah. Well, one thing I learned, I spent some time living in Singapore, and there, they were not very sophisticated. The kind of PR that the government put out or the capitalists put out and was pretty basic, almost kindergartenish, and we would have laughed at here. It wasn't sophisticated enough. But really, the song is the same. The words might change, but the song is the same. I got it, and you ain't gonna get it.
Yeah. And okay, well, thank you. And I'm glad that you're gonna have more time for Sage Adair and his adventures in the early part of 1900. So we do look forward to the next one. It's in process right now.
Yes.
Probably due out when?
It's going to be July.
Okay, July. Good. We'll have you back out when you get
All
your
right.
book finished.
Great.
Okay, Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about how are you going to structure this workshop that's going to help people collect oral histories?
We're actually partnering with KABU, I'm really excited to say. So there will be two workshops. One will be oriented towards youth and young adults in the summer, and then the second one will be oriented more towards adults. And so generally it's a three-day process. The first day we sort of talk about just what makes a good interview. How do you actively listen? How do you come up with follow-up questions? How do you prepare for an interview? How do you hold that space sacred when you're going out and doing those interviews? And then that's before you even pick up any recording devices. And then sort of after that, it is, okay, pick up the recording devices. Learn what you need to know about the technology. The technology is not the most important part, but if it doesn't work, then you've really got trouble. So, and then, we're going to send people out. They're going to choose their own interview subjects. Whose work do they want to hear about? Who's compelling to them? Because if the participants are interested, they're going to create more interesting portraits and more interesting profiles. And then they're going to come back. We're going to help teach them how to edit them. And so they're really going to be involved in the entire process of what it means to create one of these sort of portraits.
Okay. Now, you have a website that people can look at to find out more about these workshops?
Yep. It's wageworking.com, wageworking.com.
Okay. Thank you. And you have also a Facebook or website?
www.yamhillpress.net.
Yamhill Press. Okay. Well, I think that's just finishing us up for this evening. And Labor Radio is every Monday from 6 to 6:30. So please join us next Monday. And thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes
Hey Boo and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present a music documentary that raises the bar for the genre. Arrows into Infinity, the new documentary about the life of jazz musician Charles Lloyd. Thursday, April 9 at the Clinton Street Theater. Arrows into Infinity takes us on Lloyd's journey from the heights of jazz rock royalty to his life in seclusion and back again. Arrows into Infinity, the Portland premiere, Thursday, April 9, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Earlier this month, Partnership for Safety and Justice held their lobby day at the Capitol in Salem, Oregon. PSJ members met with their legislators to discuss support for continued justice reinvestment efforts to ensure adequate service.